Welcome to African American Conservatives, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement.
Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/AACONS and support our show. This is Marie Strotter, your host tonight for African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Our guests tonight are Ed Morrissey and Peter Kuo. A reminder to our audience that our show was pre-taped for the convenience of our guests. First up, we have Ed Morrissey. Ed Morrissey is the senior editor and correspondent for HotAir.com and has weekly columns at TheWeek.com and TheFiscalTimes.com. His new book is entitled Going Red, The 2 Million Voters Who Will Elect the Next President and How Conservatives Can Win Them. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You begin Going Red by forcing your readers to revisit what to many of them will be the painful memory of the 2012 presidential election, which was, in a sense, a blowout, with President Obama winning 332 electoral votes to Mitt Romney's 206, but also, in a sense, a very close election, with President Obama's winning only about 3.5 million more votes than Governor Romney out of the more than 120 million votes cast. To further add salt to our wounds, Going Red also points out that Governor Romney would have won the election had he won Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and Wisconsin, four states which had Republican governors and state legislatures. Tell us how the frustrating closeness of this 2012 result inspired you to focus on one key county in seven states that you argue holds the key to victory for Republicans in 2016?
Well, that's a good question. And I think when we talk about swing states, there's an awful lot of talk about the swing states. And it's very important, but it tends to focus our attention at a higher level than where it needs to be. So the reason why I decided to focus on the counties, the key bellwether counties in each of these seven states, is because I wanted to make sure that people understood that the elections have to be won on the local level. They have to be won in these communities that have changed significantly over the last decade, over the last couple of decades, from when they used to be Republican, either Republican bastions or at least counties where Republicans competed fairly successfully in the past. And so rather than say, well, Florida is this and here's the demographics, I wanted to introduce readers to the actual people who lived in these key bellwether counties so that, like the presidential campaigns, they would get a chance to, successful presidential campaigns, they would get to know the voters in each of these communities.
Take us through how you selected the seven counties you chose for your book. What criteria did you use that found these specific areas from states as diverse as Colorado and Florida and Wisconsin that made them so important in the Republican chances at victory in 2016?
Well, first off, the diversity is part of the issue because in both 2008 and 2012, Republicans were running a national message campaign which was basically a one-size-fits-all for every place they campaigned. And clearly, what you find when you read Going Red is that these states are different, these counties are different, they have different issues, the people are different. There's a lot of commonalities, but there's significant differences as well that a successful campaign will not just recognize, but will find ways to engage and to transform into a powerful emotional connection with these voters. So what I was looking for when I was looking at these counties is, first off, you have to decide which states it is that you want to focus on. But once you decide that, I took a look at counties where Republicans had a pretty good track record of winning presidential elections, but in 2008 went from going Republican to going Democrat. So you know, Hillsborough County, Florida, which is the Tampa area, was used to be fairly safe Republican presidential territory until Barack Obama won it in 2008. Wake County, North Carolina, used to be fairly safe Republican territory. It's been changing an awful lot over the last 20 years. And in 2008, Barack Obama took advantage of that and ended up winning Wake County. And so each of these counties is a similar sort of pattern. There is one county where Mitt Romney actually won it in 2012. That would be Brown County, Wisconsin. But he won it by such a narrow margin that it had really no impact on his statewide performance there.
You praised the 2012 Democratic presidential campaign for going hyper-local. What do you mean by hyper-local, and how should the RNC follow suit?
What I mean by hyper-local is that they contextualized their agenda for the local communities in which they were campaigning. What they were using, there was a lot of talk about how the Obama campaign in 2008 used Facebook and other social media as if it was an end in and of itself. But that's not really what the actual use of that social media was. But the actual use of that social media was to identify people in key counties, key cities, key neighborhoods that could then be transformed into ambassadors, if you will, for the Obama administration, not Obama administration, the Obama campaign's efforts to get to make these local connections. And so what they were building was a diversified network of volunteers who would become the Obama campaign's mouths, I guess you could say. They would engage their neighbors on a personal basis. They would say, you know, I talked to the Obama campaign. They've got this great idea as to how to address this particular issue that we face here in this community. And because it was personal, because it was neighbor to neighbor, because it was peer to peer, it built a strong emotional connection among voters. And that's something that Republicans failed to recognize in either 2008 or 2012.
While visiting Wake County, North Carolina, you spoke with political observer John Davis, who said that Republicans must add caring to character, arguing, quote, Republicans have this list of character attributes that doesn't include caring. But caring is character, and until they add caring to their character list, they're going to stay in trouble with the American people, end quote. But to many voters, caring from a politician is defined by free birth control, a higher minimum wage, Obamacare, 12 weeks paternity leave, and free college. These are not typical conservative fortes. We may do hugs, but we don't do giving out free stuff nearly as well as our competition. Can the Republicans compete with Democrats in an I feel your pain contest without abandoning conservative principles?
Yes, I absolutely think so. Although I do like the idea about hugs. I do. I'm a fan of hugs. But absolutely they can. I mean, this is part of what I'm talking about in this hyper-local sort of approach to politics, is that you have to actually get to know voters and get to know what their particular situations are. Caring isn't as much about giving away free stuff, because actually giving away free stuff isn't necessarily caring. Caring is about listening to what people have to say and incorporating it into a conversation rather than just asking the question simply to jot notes down on a data pad. If we're having a conversation about some issue in your neighborhood and all I'm doing is just saying, checking boxes on a survey form and say, thank you very much at the end of that conversation, well, that's not caring. That's anthropology, really, is what it is. When you have the opportunity to have a conversation in which both sides are sharing something of themselves, that is a caring environment. That is almost literally, by definition, a caring relationship. You are giving up part of yourself in order to give it to somebody else, and it's reciprocated. That type of communication, that type of politicking is that peer-to-peer is what builds loyalty. It's what builds trust. And too often, especially in the Republican Party, politicians tend to just assume that in order to be caring, you have to offer free stuff. That's not true. What you have to offer is real solutions that work, and you have to offer a really specific idea of how it will work. You can't just show up and say, well, you know, I've my family's been out of work for the last 6 months. The last manufacturer packed up and left at that point in time. There's nothing else going on. And then just sit there and talk to them about free markets and Adam Smith. I mean,
right.
Free markets, there's a lot of great things about Adam Smith. There's a lot of great things about free markets. But you have to then try to connect the dots all the way down to what their situation is. You say, look, we need to find a way to bring businesses back into this neighborhood. We need to find a way to relax some regulations in order for people to invest in this neighborhood and to build businesses here. It may not look like the same businesses that left, but we can bring people in here. There's lots of fine people in here who have skills that can be put to productive use, and I know that we can find employers to do that. And here's how the conservative agenda can do that for us. Now, if you're doing that and you're being very specific about not just what the agenda is going to do, but what you're going to do when you get elected to do that, people are going to respond to that. And especially if you're able to incorporate the specifics of what's going on in that particular community, because it shows that you're listening and it shows that you are caring, if you will, about what that person's particular plight or situation is. And it's not necessarily just a plight. I mean, it doesn't have to be the worst thing in the world, but if the roads are bad, you have to talk about how you're going to manage to improve the infrastructure while bringing a more subsidiarity type of approach to infrastructure spending, making it more local, freeing up more resources. You have to be prepared to do the hard work of explaining how conservative policies are good for people in every community.
You say that Hillsborough County, Florida, quote, holds the most potential votes that the Republicans can flip in 2016, end quote. What makes these voters so persuadable, in your opinion, Ed?
Well, I think first off, because they've been in a situation where they voted for Republicans in the past. Hillsborough County, Florida is really interesting. This is a community where when you have people who are running for office and are relating the conservative agenda to voters at the local level and at the state level, are responsive. Florida has a Republican legislature, it has a Republican governor. And the I-4 corridor in there are filled with voters who are concerned about economic prosperity, especially in the Puerto Rican community. Puerto Rican community has fled from what is a highly dysfunctional economy in Puerto Rico to live in Florida. Their voters are American citizens, just as, so when they arrive, they're ready to vote for in elections. And Republicans missed them entirely. I mean, the Republican and conservative agenda is all about economic prosperity, but they didn't translate that. They didn't even attempt to translate that into specifics for the Puerto Rican community in Hillsborough and throughout the I-4 corridor. And as a result, that went that vote went 83-17 to Barack Obama. It was a dramatic, dramatic, dramatic loss for Republicans. And even if they competed at like 40% in that community, they might have won Hillsborough County.
The importance of the African-American vote to the GOP's chances at winning a national election is no secret. As National Review writer Jeroy Murdoch, himself an African-American, wrote in 2013, quote, if 20 to 25% of blacks vote GOP, it's curtains for the Democrats, end quote. You add here in Going Red that, quote, even a small improvement for Republicans among African-American voters can make the difference between victory and defeat, end quote. Yet, like a baseball fan begging a lefty slugger to slap the ball the other way for a certain extra base hit, we watch in frustration as the GOP grounds out to the infield shift yet again. How can Republican presidential candidates reverse what you describe as a 40-year tradition of ignoring the black voter?
It's a great question. And let me tell you, when I started writing Going Red, I wasn't necessarily sure how much we were going to confront this issue head on, but I talked to some great African-American conservatives who impressed me immediately that this was a critical, critical question for the book Going Red, but also for the GOP. And I knew this already, But part of the problem, I would even say that this is that the electoral considerations of this are actually secondary. I think the moral considerations of this are primary.
Yes.
We have had a Republican Party that has written off the African American community for decades because they feel that they can't compete with Democrats among them, and so they don't even bother to try. And where that has left us, and I think it was Pudgy Miller actually who said this in the North Carolina chapter, is it leaves African Americans with a party that ignores them and another party that takes them for granted, and they have no real choice in their vote. They don't have an opportunity to weigh two different sides because they're not getting two different sides. And so when I say that even a small improvement in the vote in African-American communities would boost Republicans' electoral chances, that's true. It is true. But it's almost secondary to the fact that at least we would be providing voters in those communities with the real choice if we honestly engage those communities. And that doesn't just mean we show up a month before the election, hand out some literature, and leave a month after the election. It means we have to be part of those communities. We have to make it a long-term project. We have to make a commitment to these voters that we are not going to bail out just because we don't get an immediate return on whatever cost that you want to assign to engagement. This is, I think, a fundamental moral question. Are we going to provide people who are largely in urban areas that don't have a lot of access to other kinds of choice, are we going to provide them with at least a political choice of how to best structure their public lives so that they can benefit, especially after watching 50 years of Democratic control in urban centers? If we're not going to do that, then we really should just hang it up as a party and go home. There's no point in being a political party if we're not here to provide choice for everyone, especially if we think, and I think, you know, I'm certainly convinced that the conservative agenda is good for everybody. If it's properly applied, if it's properly run, it's good for everyone. It's not something for just one demographic over another demographic. It's good for everybody. And if it's good for everybody, why aren't we engaging everybody and telling them about it?
Absolutely right. Along these lines, Ed, many would take the inverse view to yours and ours and argue that the Republicans should fish where the fish are biting, which is with white voters. And I've had some guests on the show say that. I won't name names. People who listen to the show know that I've said it, Pat Buchanan. Such a person could point to the counties you've highlighted in your book as evidence that this strategy is correct, since the majority of these counties have very minute minority populations. New Hampshire's Hillsborough County is only 2% black, for example, and Colorado's Jefferson County is only 1% black. Even Brown County is 87% white. Do the overwhelming white majorities in the counties you've spotlighted undermine your assertion about the importance of a black vote?
No, I'll tell you why. First off, these are the swing states, and those are the counties that you're going to have to compete in. And so the demographics are just what the demographics are. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the only demographics you're going to go after. You take a look at Hillsborough County, Florida. There's a substantial Latino population. There's a substantial African-American population in Hillsborough County, Florida. In Prince William County, Virginia, the same thing. You take a look at Hamilton County, Ohio. Hamilton County, Ohio is very interesting. That is a county where you've had 12% population loss in the last 46 years. It's the only county here in this book that has had a net population loss. The city of Cincinnati has had a 40% population loss during that same period of time. And so what you've been left with in Hamilton County, because a lot of the people who left had the economic mobility to do so, is you have a high poverty rate, especially within the city of Cincinnati, and you have demographics where African Americans matter a lot. In fact, in the city of Cincinnati, I believe that African Americans comprise, I believe it's 42% of the vote. And in Hamilton County, it's I'm going to get in trouble because I don't have the figures right in front of me here, but it's substantially higher than it is for the national average. And a lot of these are not just a lot of these communities aren't, you know, poor. some of them are middle class, some of them are upper class, and you've got a whole, that's the other thing too about the perception of the African American vote. There's a great deal of diversity even within that demographic. You have to find a way to address all of those diverse populations. And Hamilton County, I would argue, would be a great laboratory, if you will, to see how well the Republican Party can actually adapt its message to other places. So no, I don't think that the presence of three of the seven counties and they're being, you know, very disproportionately white in terms of its relation to the national average, I don't think that negates it at all. I think what you're seeing is over the breadth of the seven counties that I'm talking about is the need to understand that every single one of these counties is different, that you have to understand who the people are in each of these communities in order to campaign effectively. And you have to not just understand who they are, you have to know them. You have to get to know them. You have to talk to them. You have to get them engaged, no matter what the demographics are. And the problem for Republicans is that they've been, especially with the African-American community, they've been more or less afraid to spend the effort on it. But that's a self-fulfilling defeatist prophecy. You have to start someplace. And there's a lot of very blunt talk about the challenges that Republicans are going to face when they start trying to honestly address these communities. But they're workable. There's a path there. And people want to have that engagement. And to the extent that we do not deliver it, is a failure for conservatives, it's a failure for the Republican Party.
Ed, in the book, you share a story about one of our favorite African-American conservatives, former guest on our show, Sunny Johnson, in which she offered to try to salvage the damage from Governor Romney's 47% remark by switching the conversation to, I'm not talking to the poor, I'm talking to the broke, quote unquote. Would you explain what Sunny meant by that and why her advice was largely ignored by Governor Romney's campaign?
Well, I can answer the second part of that very easily. It's because nobody was talking to Sunny, right? Sunny's terrific. I had a great time. I had a couple of great conversations with Sunny, and I've seen her a couple times since. And she was very blunt about the track record and how it's perceived. She's also blunt about another thing, too, and I think this is important. When Republicans reach out to African Americans, they reach out to Latinos, they reach out to young people, they tend to say, you should be like us. I mean, that's sort of the message, and that's the message that you get when you're doing top-down messaging. Here's what we believe. You should be part of us. No, what she's saying is you need to embrace me for who I am and tell me how what you propose is good for me. And she's very clear about that in the part of the conversation that appears in Going Red. Now, I think that the 47% remark was a mistake no matter how you cut it. And so did Sunny, and she acknowledged that. But what she was talking about with that distinction was that there's a difference between the working poor, the people who are actually out there trying to do everything right and have no money at the end of the week, none. They barely get by. They barely pay their bills. Sometimes they're falling behind. And those who just have checked out entirely and are living off of entitlements. And there's a big difference, and that first group is a lot larger than the second group. And the 47% remark lumped them all together. And I'd say that if you're talking about any sort of politics where you're going to write off 47% of the American public, you've already lost. But that's the distinction that Sunny was saying. And what Sunny was saying was this, is if the Romney campaign and the Republican Party had a good relationship with the African-American communities in these areas, they would already know the difference. They would already know what Romney actually meant, and they would have credited him with some good faith because he would have already been demonstrating that good faith. If Republicans don't demonstrate that good faith to the African American community, why should they credit Republicans with good faith when they make a verbal misstep? That's the issue that Sunny was talking about. She's absolutely correct.
And you know, we've talked about that quite a bit here on the show, just the messaging between even the wording, just outreach and inclusivity. Outreach is such a token effort. Just I'll come to your Martin Luther King breakfast or, you know, give a speech at, you know, for Black History Month or something like that versus inclusivity, which is what you touched upon. You're in my community. I want to come and sit at the table and have a part of this conversation about the issues that are plaguing this community. And Tim Scott's very good about that. You know, he goes to constituents that are not Republicans And he'll say, do you want more jobs to come to this community? Do you want better educational options for your children? And, you know, who's not going to say yes to that? So, you know, really coming to a community, engaging with the people in that community and saying, tell me what the issues are here. I want to know how I can leverage whatever I bring to the table to help find solutions, but you have this collective knowledge that I don't have, and I need to be a partner with you. You need to be a partner with me so that we can sit down and solve these problems together. And that's largely unheard of in the GOP, and that's the conversation that needs to happen.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what I'm talking about in Going Red, too. And I'm not just talking about that in African-American communities. I'm talking about that in with younger people, younger voters. I'm talking about that with women. I'm talking about that with Hispanic voters. Just plain old geographic demographics, where Republicans just don't normally go because they don't want to supposedly waste time. It's never a waste of time to build relationships. It's never a waste of time to listen to what people are perceiving on the ground are their issues. And even if you end up not agreeing on what the solutions are, you can still build trust and emotional connections with people if they perceive that you are honestly trying to get to know who they are and actually care about whether or not you succeed at it. And that's just basic. That's just basic humanity. That's basic politics. And for whatever reason, there's several reasons Republican presidential campaigns have lost the thread of that.
Another key constituency with which you say Republicans must reconnect is the Hispanic community. You even quote Hugh Hewitt as saying that the loss in 2012 can largely be explained by Republicans' failure to engage Hispanic voters in general and Spanish language media in particular. However, both the GOP frontrunners have taken very firm anti-illegal immigration views, and many with whom you spoke consider this to be a mistake. You spoke with Hispanic Republicans Tito and Deborah Munoz of Prince William County, Virginia, for example, who said they felt betrayed by the tone of the Republicans, Republicans use on immigration. Should the GOP abandon its anti-illegal immigration rhetoric, which seems to be so popular for them among non-Hispanic Republicans on the campaign trail in order to preserve its relationship with Hispanics?
Well, here's where you're going to have an issue between policies, actual policies, and tone. And I think when we were talking with Tito, by the way, Tito and Debbie are just wonderful people. I really enjoyed sitting down and talking with them. We were sitting in a market called Todos in Prince William County. And Todos was a supermarket that started off as a grocery truck run by one of Tito's former employees who just discovered that he didn't have the physique to keep up with the construction work that Tito had hired him to do. And he turned this grocery truck into two supermarkets in Virginia. And it's that type of legal immigration and economics that I think Republicans should be highlighting as a replacement for a lot of what they're talking about in regards to illegal immigration. Look, I'm kind of a border hawk. You know, I think that the border should be secure. I think the visa program should be fixed. I think if you focus on those two things and you say, look, everything else we can settle out later, let's just get those two things done. And then we can figure out what's best to do with everybody who is still here within the United States. You can actually still say, we're going to have that conversation and you may still disagree with me, but let's talk about it. Let's talk about how it's impacting your community, how it's impacting other communities. I think that there's a tone issue on that in the primary this time around. But in part, I think that might be because Republicans have not had a good opportunity to connect with those communities to understand how that messaging could be improved. And I'm not talking about abandoning principles. I'm not talking about abandoning policies. I'm talking about contextualizing policies and principles so that people who are going to vote will understand how it works on their level in their lives. And even at the end of that, we might all still disagree, but I think we'd be doing a lot less shouting at each other and a lot more conversing about what the possibilities actually are.
Absolutely. One of the great ironies of the 2016 election is that many of the Republicans who stayed home in 2012 rather than vote for Governor Romney, who they considered to be a Northeast liberal, only pretending to be a conservative, are now excited to vote for, of all people, Donald Trump. And on the flip side, voters who in 2012 still thought of President Obama as the one are now looking at Hillary Clinton as merely the next one. Donald Trump argues that if he is not the nominee, millions won't vote. Did you get a sense of that as you were researching Going Red?
No, actually I didn't. And I think actually there was an interesting poll that came out, I think it was about a week or two ago, where they asked that question of supporters of each of the five candidates who are still, for practical reasons, in the race. Trump, Cruz, John Kasich, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. And for all but John Kasich's supporters, about a third of everybody's supporters said they wouldn't vote in the general election if their preferred candidate at this point in time was not the nominee. So honestly, I think a lot of that is overblown. It's the type of thing that you expect to get from a heated primary, which both parties are having right now. And I think that the fact that you've got 3.5 months between the convention and the general election gives you a lot of time for those things to dwindle down. I actually did not get the sense that a whole lot of people were Trump or nothing when I was talking to people in the field about this election. And I would also say, just to emphasize, that this book isn't really about the nominees. It's not about any particular candidate. It's not about any candidate. It's really about the voters in these communities. So theoretically speaking, anybody can pick up Going Red and say, this is how we need to win a presidential election, and then go out and win it if they execute it properly. Now, whether, you know, some candidates might be more temperamentally suited to that or not, that's a decision that I think the delegates and maybe both parties are going to have to answer. But that's my sense of it, is that it's probably overstating the impulse to walk out of the election at this point in time.
If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Ed Morrissey. His new book is entitled Going Red, The 2 Million Voters Who Will Elect the Next President and How Conservatives Can Win Them. Ed, what's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
Well, I'm going to be on tour. I'm currently in Raleigh. I'm going to be going to Wisconsin. I'll be going to Denver, going back to the same places that I researched for the book, Going Red. And we'll be continuing to press that for the next couple of months. And I think that as we get closer to the conventions, it's going to become more and more and more relevant, the lessons in this book. And so I think what's next for me after this is, after the conventions and during the general election, is keeping tabs on how well the Republican nominee has learned these lessons and how well the Republican Party has structured itself to learn from the failures of 2012.
Excellent. The book is going supernova already at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Hope our readers will pick up a copy of that. So congratulations on the book. And thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that was our interview with Ed Morrissey. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/AACONS and choose from over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title free and start listening today. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/AACONS. Why Audible? Audible content includes more than 180,000 audio programs from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. You can get books just like the one you heard tonight from Ed Morrissey, Going Red. So go to audibletrial.com/AACONS today. Our next guest is Peter Kuo. He's a candidate here in my state of California. He is running for U.S. Congress, and here he is to introduce himself to our audience. Peter Kuo. Peter Cuo is a Republican candidate seeking to represent California's 17th district in the U.S. Congress. He's an insurance agent who started his own farmers insurance agency in 1994 and is the founder of True 3D Marketing Company. He is married and the father of three children. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Hi, Marie. Great to be on the show.
You are preparing to run for Congress as a Republican in one of the most heavily Democratic districts in the United States. Why do you think you can win?
Well, actually, I really believe I can win in this particular election is because the following. One, we have the largest Asian American district outside of Hawaii in the United States. And 55% of the population are Asian American, made up of Asian American population. And the voters, of course, has a very large block as well. And yes, I only have 18% of the Republican registered in this district, but majority of the Asian American, for some reason, has decided to be independent versus registering for the Democratic Party. So I have about 33% of the independent voters and 48% of the Democratic voters in this particular district. And the reason I believe I can win is not because I'm Asian. It's simply that I believe my value is the most closely associated with the value that they grew up with. And so I really think I have a shot this time just because, again, Mike Honda has been there for a very long time, and yes. And I have a very strong opponent, Ro Khanna, who has raised about $2.5 million. I have about $2,500, so it's truly a David versus Goliath match. But I simply want to make sure that I give extra choice for the voters of CD17.
Given the companies that are headquartered there, especially Apple and Yahoo, your district may be one of the most important areas in the country. And in an area largely dependent upon these tech giants for tax revenue and jobs, you wrote, quote, "As your congressman, I will work to assure that not only does Silicon Valley remain the innovation capital of the world, but to assure that it remains the greatest idea incubator in America," end quote. What are some of the steps you intend to take to do so?
Yes. So in the past 12 years, I have been, in addition to the insurance agency that I've been running for 22 years, I also have a consulting firm that I've been helping the technology companies here on the stuff that they invented to be brought to the retail market. So, for example, if you were to invent the latest and best LED light bulb, for example, and say this thing is manufactured in China, we can actually make sure that your invention get produced at the very, at the lowest cost. And again, today's market is most likely manufacturing is still in China. So we can actually bring that particular product and to have a successful launch right here in Silicon Valley. So I've been helping a lot of companies doing exactly that. And I know the ins and outs of how a technology can help people's lives to improve their lives. And not just in products, I actually have a lot of apps company that has been I've been helping to get them funding and also basically I'm one of the sharks in the shark tank. I helped to connect them with the VCs, venture capitalists here in Silicon Valley to make sure that their idea becomes a reality. So I've been doing that for the past 3 years and been quite good at it. So I think I know what the venture capitalists are looking for. I also know what the entrepreneurs are going through. So I think out of all the candidates, they don't have my kind of experience to make things better here for the Silicon Valley.
One of the greatest challenges California faces is that it is perceived by much of the rest of the country as a state that not only is increasingly unfriendly to capitalism, but to Christianity as well.
to reference a recent story that made national headlines, California is seen as a state where parents are required to have their teenage daughters share showers with the transgendered, or at least to many outside the state. What can you do as a congressman to change this perception of our state?
Being a Christian myself, I became a Christian when I was 18 years old, walking on campus at San Jose State the first day of school. I put my faith in God that day when the missionary shared that faith, shared this faith with me. I became a born-again Christian that day. And, in fact, went to this on a short-term missionary trip to Japan when I was senior in college. So I know the Christian value very, very well. And, of course, growing up, I was a Buddhist. And then, I married an Indonesian wife who has a half of her family were Muslims. And now I have a Jewish business partner and a Hindu business partner. So I think as far as religion-wise, I know the cultures inside out pretty well. And when it comes to transgender in particular, again, there's a difference between gay and transgenders in the sense that there are special needs for a transgender. But I don't think that solution that we have, that we passed, to allow transgender to use the locker rooms or bathroom of their choice is the right solution. And I North Carolina recently rescinded all the laws they passed to protect the transgender. And I feel it was a step towards the right direction, but I also feel that it probably took a step too far trying to negate all the progress that we've made. So I'm hoping people perceive California as a common sense state versus an extremely liberal state. And I disagree with Mayor Edward Lee's executive order, so to speak, to ban all travel to North Carolina just because of this issue. And I think, again, there's a lot of common sense solution we can come up with instead of this drastic law allowing transgender to use bathroom. If that's the only thing that they're concerned about, let's look at the bigger picture of, our female students being attacked by the transgender in the bathroom. So those are the things we need to come up with a common sense solution as far as, that particular issue is concerned. And I'll bring the message saying we are working towards a common goal. And this is probably most of the things I will try to do is work towards a common goal and get. And I'm a good listener. I'll get as much input as possible from everybody, not just my church friends or the parents of the quote unquote right wings extremists that the media has been painting us into.
Peter, healthcare is another important issue to you. Do you intend to work toward repealing Obamacare? If so, what would you like to see replace it?
Okay, so I am an insurance agent. So Obamacare, when it first came out, I really liked it in the sense that, yes, it provides coverage regardless of your health qualification. And but in the same token, I realized a few months later after Obamacare happened, I realized that basically a big part of my income selling health insurance commissions were taken away. So on the selfish side of me, I didn't like it just because I wasn't able to make money off it as an insurance agent. But I also understand the bigger good. It now provides coverage for a lot of people who were not uninsurable before. Now, comes to the answer to your question, would I work on repeal Obamacare? Absolutely, because I see what's going on firsthand. What it does to the physicians. A lot of physicians I know nowadays don't even accept Obamacare. And the skyrocketed premium that has been suffered by a lot of people. Who it's a giant, colossal failure. So if your doctor don't accept Obamacare, or most hospitals don't accept it, what good does it do for 90% of people who is paying the premium? And so they basically bought into a product that is completely not doing what it's supposed to do. It's almost, my scenario will be, if you have a flat tire, would you total the car and just build the cars with square tires? No, I mean, it just doesn't make sense at all. So I think we will need to at the very least repeal it, but include a clause that still allow people to buy even if they have pre-existing condition. And my approach will be similar to car insurance. I mean, as long as you own a car, you can buy insurance at your own money. And if you really need help, you know, that's where the government system comes in. So that way, it's a more balanced approach versus one size fits all. And again, insurance product it's not a one size fits all product at all. So many people try to think of it that way, but it's not. Even car insurance, there are so many variations. Depends on your driving record, where you live, how far you drive. Those are the type of things that we should consider versus three questions on Obamacare: where you live, your age, and your sex. And that in itself is not enough for any insurance company to come up with the data to properly rate a premium for any customer. So yes, Obamacare needs to be repealed, needs to be revamped, but make sure that we include a reasonable price that people can pay and use, choose the doctor they like, et cetera.
You've said, quote, as your congressman, I will work to assure education policy is left in the hands of local communities, end quote. As you know, California is in a dire situation as far as our educational system is concerned. Do you intend to oppose Common Core, and what is your stance on school choice and repairing our broken school system?
I would absolutely repeal Common Core. I have an eighth grader. I mean, I could not do his homework for him, math questions in particular, in the past 2 years, ever since Common Core was implemented, or longer, I don't remember now. I remember he came home one day with an algebra question. I could not help my little guy. I just can't, because the answer they were looking for was, the way they want to get to an answer is not what I was taught growing up. And it frustrates me to no end. I actually have to hire a tutor so that he could teach me how to, you know, work on Common Core math questions. And you know, I have a darn near perfect score when I took the SAT back when I attended Abraham Lincoln High School in San Jose. But now I couldn't even help my kid to do his homework. And all because of the Common Core, because the way they structure those questions are just so out of touch, right, with common sense. So,
right.
Yes, I will work to repeal that. And the thing is about education, it's all we have. I mean, my parents came to this country in 1982, when they were persecuted by the government back then. So we came here, and the most important thing my dad has always told me when I was growing up is, you study hard, you work hard, you will get to where you want to be. And that has always been my head for the past, you know, 30 years. And so Asian American put education as their priority simply because that's their only way out. We can't play basketball better than, you know, our counterpart. We can't throw football better than our counterpart. But the only thing we can do is study better, and that's has been the Asian American way to ensure that opportunity is there. Again, we are not looking for handouts. We're not looking for you to lower the basket so we can dunk a hoop. We're not asking for that. We're asking for the equal opportunity. And what the legislators in California have been doing is tried to bring back affirmative action, which you abolished back in the 1990s. Again, what affirmative action is saying that as long as you're a particular racial group, you can actually get into higher education, employment, and government contracting. That has been the Democratic platform to use affirmative actions versus merit-based society. So I really have a lot of problem with the direction that our legislature have been taking lately. As recent as last week, Assemblyman Rob Bonta in East Bay has introduced an assembly bill to basically divide all the Asian American into additional 10 categories. So, for example, I will be called a Taiwanese American, and my kids, since their mom is from Indonesia, they probably have to put Taiwanese Indonesian American. And so that part, I was completely baffled, because since when are we needing this type of data to categorize our children, right? I mean, and they don't ask the same law to be applied to the Latino community or even the white community versus the German American. You know, they don't ask you to see if you're German, if you're English, or you know, if you're Irish, but they want us, the Asian American, to do this. So I strongly disagree with that particular policy, trying to, under the guise of equality and diversity. And so those are the things that I really oppose and will fight against this type of affirmative action to justify, you know, our entrance to higher education, employment, and government contracting.
America is replete with examples of immigrants or children of immigrants who have achieved great success in our country. They've helped start countries like Google and Yahoo and Tesla. They win Nobel Prizes and Pulitzers. One child of an immigrant may be our next president. As an immigrant yourself, would you share with us your thoughts about why the immigration experience has been so rewarding, not just for the immigrants and their children, but for our country as well?
Marie, that is such a great question. I came to this country when I was 14, so as a disclaimer, I can't be U.S. president because I was not a natural-born citizen. So that's put that out of the way for now. But I really believe that all my counterparts, I mean, as far as entrepreneurs that I know and insurance agents and people who are serving the community, working hard to serve the community, are mostly immigrants. And, you know, most of them come here at a younger age, you know, like me, and they have excelled in school and the sports of their choice sometime. And those are the people I really think that can really make America better. And I myself had a very long immigration road, per se. I only became a U.S. citizen about 10 years ago. And prior to that, you know, I came to this country legally, and it took me literally 20 years before I become a U.S. citizen. So it's a lot of hard work, and I really believe that we can reward and help people who have entrepreneur ideas, you know, who wants to start their own business, and help them in a sense that don't let them, because of their immigration status, and we lose them, you know, back to Asia. And so if you're referring to H-1B visa, I would encourage that we expand the numbers, because they are not really competing against our U.S.-owned graduates. There are just simply not enough engineers to go around in Facebook and Yahoo and Apple to meet the demand. So I would, you know, one thing is probably increase the H-1B visa. You know, keep the best and brightest here in this country versus, and they mostly want to stay here in this country anyway. Why send them home, right? Because we have educated them for a very long time. So that, in a sense, is our secret weapon to keep America ahead of other countries. So don't let that brain drain out of here after they have completed a degree and training here. So that's one aspect I would advocate. And secondly, again, being an immigrant myself, I understand what I've gone through as far as immigration goes. And not everybody is set to be an engineer, but they want to pay taxes. They want to be a contributing member of the society. So we should really encourage that as well. And finally, it comes to illegal immigration. Again, I will be the first one to stand up and say, you know, I know a lot of them among my friends. They're hardworking people. They left their family because of, you know, political persecution like I had. And they just didn't have the means and ability to become legal, to come here legally at that time. But we should really look at each individual cases and make sure if they have no criminal history, let's, you know, keep them here. and they can be contributing to our society as well. So I think there's a lot of common ground and common goals that we are all trying to reach. And that's work towards that versus, you know, name calling and trying to kick everybody out. I just didn't think that make any sense at all.
As an immigrant and a resident of California, one of the things which the congressman, San Jose is a sanctuary city, similar to our great neighbor to the north, San Francisco. What is your view of sanctuary cities, and what do you feel is our appropriate response to it?
You know, I feel that we as a society has failed to protect our citizens, and I also realize that sanctuary city policies can encourage criminals to come to the cities or whatever, you know, San Jose or San Francisco. We actually encourage them to come to the city to commit crimes, and that's an extreme, you know, both side of view, both sides on the sense that, hey, let's make San Jose sanctuary city. That policy should be, again, instead of say, you know, we're not going to deport you completely, versus let's just deport everybody. There's got to be a way we can find out a way in the middle without jeopardizing the safety of the citizens. Again, that's pretty much the most important job a government has to do, is protect its citizens from violence, especially from illegal immigrants. And to say that, okay, you come here, you commit a crime, we're not going to deport you, that is just craziness, right? So, no, I do not agree with sanctuary city policies, but I also realize we can't deport everybody. Let's find a middle ground on how, you know, illegal immigrant who committed violent acts, they should be sent back, no question asked. And the people who's been working hard, providing for the family here, especially their children, if they're U.S. citizens, we shouldn't torn them apart and set them all home just because they are illegal. That's the policy I will work on very hard to get input from everybody, and try to come up with a policy that is, again, common sense solution is for California is pretty much my slogan for running, and I think yes, we can make this society not too extreme on either side. But I do disagree with sanctuary city policies.
One of the things which Mike Honda, the congressman who currently holds the seat to which you aspire, is most proud of is receiving the endorsement of Planned Parenthood. As a candidate who is pro-life, how are you connecting with your constituency in such a pro-choice area?
Yes. Again, I understand the the views of the pro-choice. Again, I'm not disagreeing with them. It's their lives. It's their soul. And I really have no right to tell them what to do. But on the same token, I wish, again, if I were be able to scream on top of the mountain to make a policy that you can't have abortion anymore, that's not going to be my priority. But I want people to know this, is that in Asia in particular, I wouldn't name countries, if you were to born a girl in certain countries,
yeah,
that they will just smother the little baby by putting a wet towel over her nose until she stopped breathing. And that has been going on. Sex selection abortion or sex selection murder has been going on in that part of the world for a very long time. Now, so that's a start. Can we have a conversation about this? Can we have a conversation about sex selection abortion or sex selection murder? So every fiber of my being saying killing is wrong, killing is wrong. And but I also realize there are people who want to have that choice to terminate what's inside their body, and it's their right. I'm not going to make that into a legislative priority. But I also want the people, the legislators, especially the citizens of CD17, to realize there are so much more alternative options you can have, such as adoption. I mean,
yes.
My campaign manager, Jason Scalise, who has been trying to adopt kids, and they burn through their personal assets just trying to adopt a child. It is the process I've seen what he has done through just breaks my heart. And, I believe adoption shouldn't cost more than an abortion if we can make it that way, right? And I have a lot of friends who love to have kids, but they can't because the adoption process is so difficult. It's almost like winning a lottery. And can we at least come to a conclusion or a common ground that, hey, there are so many people who want to have a baby girl or boy, but they can't. Can we come up with a solution for that versus just, black or white? That's work on a rainbow of solutions to make this world a better place, and versus putting our life altogether. And I think I will work hard on it. But is it going to be my priority to ban all abortions? Most likely not. But I would advocate the pro-life people to ask them to consider the other alternatives before they do the ultimate decision to terminate their life, Yeah.
Congressman Honda has been among the most outspoken in support of President Obama's plan to welcome thousands of Syrian refugees, claiming that he was, quote, appalled by the calls for rejecting Syrian refugees, end quote. But in light of the recent terror attacks in Europe, and the wave of refugee-related crimes, should Congressman Honda and President Obama reconsider their stances?
Absolutely. They should really, really reconsider. Again, I, literally half of my in-laws, they're Muslims, and they are amazing Muslims. The faith towards their God, which is the same God, in my opinion, just simply amazing. The way they worship, how faithful they are. It is truly remarkable. But there are the extremists who take advantage of our kindness and try to kill us. And those are the people we really should prevent them from disguising us as one of the refugees and coming into our country. And yes, they should definitely reconsider, absolutely.
Interestingly, California Republicans will play an unusually important role in the GOP primary, as it has It's 176 delegates, and it may decide whether the Republican presidential candidate will be Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. Not only are you running for Congress, but you are currently the chair of the Asian American Coalition for Ted Cruz. How has the support for Senator Cruz been in the Asian community, and what can we expect as the primary draws closer?
Yes, personally, I support Ted Cruz for his stance on many issues. Again, we don't agree 100% on everything, on his policies. However, I believe his values represent identifies with most of the Asian American values, the pro-family stance, the pro-opportunity stance, so those are the policies I believe Asian Americans should realize that Republican, not only just Ted Cruz, but also Republican Party most closely resembles to their ideology and values. And I would very much like to let the Asian American voters and community know that, you know, instead of vote for the DNR next to the candidate's name, look into who they are.
Yes.
And make choice that way. Please don't just because he has a D or R or, you know, R1, R2, R3, make that rash decision, because this is going to be so important. It's been a long time, what, 40 years, Marie, now? That
yes.
California hasn't been relevant in choosing our next president, because it has been long decided before they come to California. But this year, we finally have a chance to make that particular impact in the in choosing a president. So I would really encourage not just Asian American, but everyone to choose wisely. It is so important. I mean, this is going to shape our country's future for the next decade.
That's right.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, our guest for this segment has been Peter Kuo. He's a Republican running for California's 17th district in the U.S. Congress. Peter, what's next for you, and how can we follow and support your campaign?
You know, currently I have raised about $5,000, and my opponent has $2.5 million on one and $1.8 on the other. It is truly a David versus Goliath election. And I want to share with everybody, you know, if you can't give me $10, that's okay. But tell your friend who live in CD 17 to vote for a common sense guy right here, Peter Kuo. He's going to try to not just bridge the gap between the poor and the rich. Because I was dirt poor growing up. The government took everything from my family. We came to this country with, you know, four luggages, and that was it. And yet, through hard work and the opportunity that this country has given me, I was able to have a wonderful family and two successful businesses I'm running right now. It's time for me to give back. But I really appreciate it if you can do a small donation. I would say less than $10. That's okay. And to show that you support a guy who is going to bring common sense solutions to California, especially right here in Silicon Valley.
Peter, give us the URL for your campaign website, please.
Yes, it's peterkuo.org. Very simple. I promise that's the shortest name out of all the candidates here. So it's peterkuo.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Absolutely, Marie.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.